handful of Christians, even a single man, was enough to launch riots in Ephesus and Jerusalem. Look at Acts 19 and Acts 21. So similar riots in Rome would not prove anything about numbers. Another useless piece of evidence is the Book of Revelation, which says there will be a total of 144,000 virgin Jewish men saved. But there is no reason to believe the unknown author of this text was using any kind of actual count or data, for the book is a record of a mystical vision and about the future, Revelations 1, verses 1 to 3, and not a historical fact drawn from any kind of real source. We also don't know when the book was written or when the author imagined this count would be reached. Moreover, the number is calculated mystically. Exactly 12,000 Jews will come from each of the 12 tribes, Revelation 7, verses 5 to 8. Every single one of them a virgin, Romans 14, verse 4. Clearly, we're not looking at any kind of historical report here. Likewise, when Aristides wrote an address to the emperor Hadrian, between 117 and 138 AD, in which he called the Christians a new class of people, this offers no hint of what kind of numbers Aristides had in mind, since the appellation has nothing to do with number or size, but with categorical distinction. The Christians constituted a new category because their customs and beliefs differed from the traditional categories of the ancient world, such as barbarian, Greek, or Jew. Aristides makes no clear statement about the number of his brethren, and at any rate, this document falls well outside the first century and is explicitly apologetic and thus subject to hyperbole. So again, there is no useful data here. Some have argued that an anonymous quotation in the 5th century text of Sulpicius Severus really comes from the lost books of the histories of Tacitus, and since the passage says the Romans specifically destroyed the Jewish temple to eradicate the Christians, this implies a substantial Christian presence in Judea as of 70 AD. But Severus doesn't say he is quoting Tacitus. It's only by dubious stylistic speculation that the passage is attributed to Tacitus at all, and most scholars believe the passage was redacted by Christians anyway. Indeed, Severus plainly appears to be quoting or paraphrasing a source that credited God with ensuring the temple's destruction, something Tacitus would never do, while another author, Orosius, who clearly used the same source, makes no mention of Titus having Christianity in mind. So this evidence is tainted and unreliable. Even the action proposed, destroying the temple, could not plausibly have crushed the Christian movement, so the story is inherently unbelievable as a reference to Christians in our sense. But even if this passage in Severus does go back to Tacitus, or some other author of the same period, it doesn't help us, for we would still not know what drew the ire of the Romans on that occasion, since, as already noted, Acts claims that Christians could make a substantial nuisance of themselves even when very few. The fact that Romans like Nero found a reason to get rid of them only 6 years before Titus razed the temple doesn't entail it was their vast numbers that annoyed him. Nero may well have found Christians to be the handiest scapegoats for the burning of Rome because they preached that the world would soon be set on fire. See 2 Peter 3, verses 5 to 13. Or because Paul, all by himself, supposedly had personally secured Nero's attention by causing a riot in Jerusalem. Look at Acts 21 and 28. Which would make Paul, and therefore his movement, a visible cause of unrest in a troubled province on the brink of a rebellion only a couple years away. Moreover, if Titus believed the Christians were responsible for burning Rome, a crime Tacitus says they'd been convicted of only a few years earlier, that would be reason enough to want to get rid of them, no matter how few of them there were. And given all these fires, riots, and complaints from the Jewish leadership, Titus could easily have thought the movement was larger than it really was. But even if numbers were the issue, the 5,000 Christians alleged to exist in Acts would constitute almost an entire legion, certainly enough for a Roman general to worry about. But not enough by 70 AD to constitute an impressive popularity for holding's purpose, even if we were to make all the groundless leaps of speculation needed to get that far. It has also been claimed that laws would not have been passed against Christians unless there were a lot of them. But even if that were so, how many would there have to be? Any answer would be a purely subjective judgment. Given the fact that Christians routinely engaged in bold and public behavior in several major cities, it would not require many to gain legal attention. Again, Acts shows a mere handful could and did cause several riots, illegal plots, and official charges under Roman law. And 100 per city in, say, 20 cities would be more than visible enough to warrant a government response, yet is still only a total of 2,000 out of more than 60 million people. So, yet again, even with very small numbers, they could make a public nuisance of themselves. Indeed, a single man, Paul, sends the entire city of Jerusalem into chaos and gets nearly every Roman official involved all the way up to the emperor, or so we're told, and Christians were certainly a known presence in Rome by the time of Nero. So even if there were laws specifically against being Christian in the first century, that tells us nothing useful about how many Christians there were. There is also another catch-22 here. Holding argues that the status of Christianity as a capital crime entails not only that their numbers were large, but also that the evidence must have been overwhelming, or else no one would have joined when the penalties were so high. But this argument requires two premises. Premise one, unless evidence of divine support was overwhelming, large numbers of people would not become Christians if it was a capital crime. And premise two, if being a Christian in and of itself was a capital crime, then Christians must have existed in large numbers. And since premise two contradicts premise one, unless evidence of divine support was overwhelming and Christianity was a capital crime, Holding's conclusion is thus upheld if premise one and premise two are true. The problem is that any advocate of premise two must then contend with the fact that it was also a capital crime to rob graves. In fact, from the first two centuries, we have far more evidence of laws against grave robbing than for any laws mentioning Christians. Hence, premise two analogously entails that if there were laws against robbing graves, then hundreds of thousands of people must have been grave robbers, which entails premise three. Hundreds of thousands of people would engage in lethally dangerous and socially despised behavior without overwhelming evidence of divine support. Premise 3 refutes premise 1. Therefore, one must retreat from this fatal assumption and admit to premise 4 instead. Only a tiny fringe minority engaged in grave robbing. And that's probably true. Certainly fewer than a tenth of 1% of the population could ever have been grave robbers. But if premise 4 is true, then mutatis mutandis, premise 2 is false, and laws could be passed against tiny fringe minorities. Therefore, even if there were laws specifically against Christians, this would not entail that they were more than a tiny fringe minority. You can only escape this conclusion by denying premise 4, but denying premise 4 entails denying premise 1, which refutes Holding's entire thesis. Something has to give, and for Holding, that must be premise 2. Therefore, Holding cannot argue from the existence of laws against Christianity to the conclusion that Christians existed in vast numbers. But the fact is, there is no evidence of any actual law against Christianity anyway, until at best the mid-second or early third century. Prior to that, Christians were rarely prosecuted at all, and even when they were, it was for other generic crimes against Rome, not simply for being Christian. Paul, we're told, ended up before Gallio on a vague charge of soliciting criminal behavior, but is charged as a Jew, Acts 16, verses 20 to 21. Even Nero had to formally charge Christians with arson to get away with killing them. Tacitus says the charge of arson was probably a bogus accusation that merely served to shift blame for the burning of Rome off Nero and onto a hated minority, which entails Christianity was otherwise not illegal at the time, since false charges were needed to kill them. In case anyone might question the point, it's clear the formal charge was arson, as Tacitus says, consciously employing formal legal terminology. Number one, in order to get rid of the rumor that he had burned Rome, Nero invented culprits, where here reus, culprit, is the formal term for a defendant at trial. It's the standard word for a person charged with a crime or tort. And since the very purpose for inventing defendants is to shift the blame for arson, clearly arson had to be the charge. And number two, quote, and at first those were seized who confessed, end quote, where here the word fateor is also the formal term for admitting guilt, and the context makes clear they had to be confessing to arson since that was the offense invented for which they had become defendants. Number three, quote, then, from evidence they provided, a huge number were convicted, end quote, where indicio, evidence, is another legal term, and convinco, proved guilty, is a formal term for winning a conviction at trial. Number four, Tacitus then says they were convicted, quote, not as much for the crime of arson as because of the hatred of the human race, end quote. Thus outright saying that the real formal crime, crimen, was arson, incendium, while the ulterior motive that led to inventing this charge and that biased juries against them was hatred of the human race, which can mean either that the human race hated them or that Roman jurors believed the Christians hated the human race. Number five, Tacitus does say that as a result of their treatment, quote, although it was against those who were guilty and deserved the most extreme deterrence, sympathy for them arose as they were destroyed not so much for the public good, but to serve the savagery of one man, end quote. But here Tacitus drops the formal legal vocabulary and is thus only declaring a personal judgment against Christians. so Tacitus attests to no law against being Christians. Even by the early 2nd century, when Pliny the Younger, incidentally a close friend of Tacitus, asked the Emperor Trajan what the law was against Christians, Trajan replied, quote, "It is not possible to establish anything in general that has a specific form, so to speak," end quote. In legal jargon, that meant there was no actual law, and so Pliny had to use his own judgment. In Roman law, when someone went to trial, the relevant law stated how the judge was to apply a formula to the case, which simply made it a matter of satisfying the formula with adequate evidence. Trajan is thus saying there is no such formula. Therefore, there was no law. Trajan even specifically rejects the opportunity to make one. He could have established a formula, but instead says it's impossible to do so for Christians. Hence, the only general test Trajan suggests is the same one Pliny came up with on his own, even before he knew why Christians were criminals, which is to test whether the accused is a member of an illegal political society, first by asking them to renounce this, then, to make sure they are telling the truth, asking them to do something otherwise trivial that Pliny was told members of their association would never do. This means Pliny understood Christianity as already violating existing laws against illegal associations, and therefore no specific law against Christianity was required. Membership in illegal associations was already a capital crime, particularly in Pliny's province, since any formal association required an approval or a special license issued by the government, which sought assurances that the association was not a covertly treasonous movement against the Roman order. This explains why Pliny the Younger regarded obstinacy, a refusal to renounce a social affiliation, as sufficient evidence of guilt. This also explains why it appears they were tried for the name Christian, since Christiani can mean members of the party of Christ, in the same way the Pompeiani were the supporters of Pompey against Caesar, and Pliny's test of their loyalty, renouncing their affiliation and proving their sincerity in this, is considered sufficient proof of innocence or guilt. This corresponds perfectly to the charge against them specifically identified in Acts, quote, "acting contrary to the decrees of Caesar by saying there is another king, Jesus," end quote. Acts 17, verse 7. In fact, if even a single man went around all by himself proclaiming he was a Brutian, a supporter of the party of Brutus, Pliny could have executed him on the charge of being a member of the Brutiani, not because there was any law specifically against being one, but simply because it was illegal for anyone to support a political party other than Caesar's. Therefore, the Pliny-Trajan correspondence entails there was no specific law against Christians. Indeed, Trajan outright says there is no such law, and then he specifically tells Pliny not to hunt Christians down. So this was not a government that wanted them exterminated. I'll say more about Pliny's letter later in this chapter. So we are left with no useful evidence of the size of the Christian movement in the first century. Even the only definite number we have, the 5,000 in Acts, comes from an unknown source and is reported by an author with an obvious bias towards exaggerating the popularity of his movement. We also have no idea how such a number could have been known to Luke. Who counted? Even if we set all that aside, we still don't get as far as we need to in order to prop up Paulding's case. Reasonable estimates for the total population of the whole of Palestine in the first century approach about 2.5 million. So a church of even 25,000 members, five times the largest size Luke himself dares to claim, would make up only 1% of the population there. In reality, it's doubtful the Christian church ever maintained even that size throughout Palestine in the first century, and there's no real evidence it did. Meanwhile, outside Palestine, we have no numbers at all, not even from Luke. All we get is a general impression of winning converts here and there, but whenever anything more precise is said, we rarely hear of more than several households per town. Even at our most optimistic, that doesn't look good. We could perhaps imagine 100 Christians per city by the year 100, which would be a shockingly visible presence given the small size of ancient towns and the nosiness of ancient cultures, as Holding himself made a point of, as we discussed in chapter 13. But even by the most optimistic estimates, Christians had then penetrated fewer than 70 towns or cities across the whole empire, and that only makes for a total of 7,000 people. Again, that's socially microscopic. We also have to consider that there could have been a lot of apostates. Enthusiasts might profess nominal allegiance, receive a free baptism as yet another egg in their basket of supernatural security, and then find out the truth, or think things through, or just not care anymore. Christian sources obviously avoid admitting that anyone abandoned the faith, and in fact the only useful observation we have on this phenomenon comes from Pliny the Younger, in his highly rhetorical epistle to Emperor Trajan, as we discussed before. Pliny's account of his own investigation into local Christianity reveals that there were a significant number of Christians who did not remain converts. They left of their own accord, even without persecution. Pliny found locals, around 112 AD, who had ceased being Christians, quote, 2 or more years ago, and some of them even 20 years ago, end quote. And still more were quick to abandon their beliefs once Pliny threatened them with execution. So we know Christianity had to contend with making up losses. It didn't create some miraculous landslide of unshakable belief. But even more telling is the fact that Pliny the Younger starts right off by admitting, quote, I have never been present at an examination of Christians, end quote. In fact, he says he knows nothing about how they are to be punished or even charged. This is proof positive that Christians must have been extremely scarce, truly to the point of social invisibility. Pliny had been governor in Asia Minor for over a year already, before even learning there were any Christians in his province, and before that he held the post of consul, the highest possible office in the entire Roman Empire, short of actually being emperor. He had also been a lawyer in Roman courts for several decades, then served in Rome as praetor, the ancient equivalent of both chief of police and attorney general, and then served as one of Trajan's top legal advisors for several years before he was appointed to govern Bithynia. It's therefore absolutely incredible that Pliny had never attended a prosecution of Christians and knew absolutely nothing about how to prosecute them. He didn't even know why being a Christian was illegal. Therefore, Christians must have been extremely rare indeed throughout the entire empire, and even at Rome, where Pliny had decades of legal experience. For this means he never once saw a trial, nor had a Christian brought before him, nor ever heard the issue discussed in the Senate, the courts, or porticos, or by any of his peers, not in Asia until this occasion, nor as top legal advisor to Trajan, nor as a leading law officer in Rome, nor as a lawyer, not even when he held the highest office in the land. That is simply not possible, unless Christians were barely there. That does a lot to corroborate Rodney Stark's conclusion, as I'll point out later. Some Christian apologists today try to use Pliny the Younger's exaggerated panic as evidence that Christianity was a huge hit. For Pliny claims, quote, temples had for a long time been almost entirely deserted, and sacred rites had been allowed to lapse, and scarcely anyone could be found to buy sacrificial animals, end quote. These are obvious rhetorical exaggerations, but, Pliny declares with relief, these have all become popular again. Is Pliny saying Christianity had practically eclipsed paganism all around him? That's impossible, for had that been so, how could he know nothing about it? And why would he need informers and anonymous lists to find the Christians? Throughout his letter, Pliny appears shocked and surprised to suddenly be finding Christians all over the place. Though he doesn't say how many, his astonishment makes no sense if it had become a major local practice. The fact is, Pliny does not say this decline in pagan worship was the consequence of people flocking to Christianity. Apologists simply read that inference into the text. Rather, with classic rhetorical flourish, Pliny is claiming that piety in general had declined into apathy, but people were finding religion again, and that was a good sign because it meant they would stop straying into barbaric superstitions like Christianity and return instead to zealous patriotism. Otherwise, as Pliny's story plainly reveals, you had to look pretty damned hard even to find a local Christian. Numbers, what the experts say. Sociologist Rodney Stark presents a quick survey of important considerations and scholarship regarding the actual rate of growth of Christianity in its first century. He notes that the highest estimate of Christian numbers ever in bona fide scholarship is 15 million believers in the year 300 AD. Scholarly consensus, however, tends quite strongly toward half that figure, or even less. Given the best estimate of the total population of the Roman Empire at 60 million, this means that even by the most favorable scholarly estimate on record, Christians comprised only 25% of the population, even after nearly 300 years of evangelism. And most scholars agree the ratio at that time was probably closer to 10%. Even so, all scholars agree a ratio higher than 25% is completely unsupportable. As Stark rightly points out, and he is a sociologist by profession, a final number like this allows us to predict the average rate of growth over the previous centuries from known historical precedents and scientific models. Stark does the math and demonstrates that only a rate of growth of around 40% per decade fits the actual data we have as well as known precedents. It roughly matches the rate of growth of the Mormon Church, for example. Many of Stark's assumptions have been challenged or corrected by actual historians of antiquity, in work that should now be required reading on the subject of the expansion of Christianity, but all the conclusions reached by these scholars support or corroborate my analysis in this chapter and throughout this book. Bruce Molina, for example, has also criticized Stark, arguing that Stark's estimated growth rate is too high. Quote, 220 bishops, so Henry Chadwick says, attended the Council of Nicaea, called by Constantine in AD 325. These bishops functioned in a face-to-face society. Now, in a face-to-face society, the maximum number of persons with whom one can interact is around 4,000. So the anthropologist, Jerry Boissevain. Hence, scientifically speaking, that is, mathematically, the number of Christians at the time of the Council of Nicaea was around 880,000, the result of a growth rate of around 2.5% per year. Hence, Stark postulates a growth rate that is exaggeratedly high, end quote. However, I'm skeptical of Molina's assumptions, and most scholars argue for a much larger Christian presence by the 4th century, about 5 times Molina's number. So I will assume the exaggeratedly high estimates of Stark are at present the most reasonable. But Stark's model only estimates a rate of growth of roughly 3.42% per year. So if there is one missionary for every 100 members, he would convince less than 4 more people to join each year, which is not remarkable. And if there were more missionaries than that, then they were even less successful. Of course, in models like Stark's, growth stops when market saturation is achieved. In other words, when all customers who want the product have bought the product. And there is no telling when Christianity actually hit that ceiling. But in order not to bias his results with contrary assumptions, Stark assumes there was no such ceiling. In other words, that everyone could be convinced the product was desirable. Which suits holding, but probably not reality. In reality, Christianity probably never could have gained a majority until it became favored by Rome and then required by Rome, 2 conditions that each would have expanded the attractiveness of the product and thus raised the ceiling for market saturation. This was especially true when Christians started killing those who didn't buy it, or exiling them or seizing their property and so on, thus gaining 100% saturation only by outright eliminating non-buyers. By analogy, picture Microsoft actually murdering all Mac users and then boasting everyone uses Windows. At any rate, Stark surveys the evidence from antiquity that corroborates his estimated growth rate, and he's probably right, for there is no evidence to contradict him, and what little evidence we have supports him. Indeed, as Stark explains, the strongest evidence we have, Roger Bagnall's hard data from Egyptian papyrological documents, quite agrees with Stark's growth curve. Moreover, most experts also agree with Stark's conclusion. I'll mention Hopkins, Fox, and Finn soon. So there is no plausible case to be made against Stark's estimate on this point. No evidence counters it. All relevant evidence supports it. One could still insist the numbers were higher and that somehow no real evidence of this survives, but any argument based on a blind conjecture is itself a blind conjecture, and that won't suit Holding's argument at all, since you can't get from blind conjecture to irrefutable evidence no matter how hard you try. The fact is, the evidence we have agrees only with Stark, so if we reject Stark, we still have no evidence the numbers were higher. Yet Stark's conclusion entails there could not have been more than 8,000 Christians in the church by the end of the 1st century, which fits the picture we drew before of 100 Christians in each of 70 towns, more than enough to visibly cause problems here and there, but nowhere near enough to make Holding's case. However, we must not confuse this number with the number of converts in the 1st century, for almost all the converts made in the 40s would be dead by the year 100, and there is also the inevitable question of apostasy. In both cases, Stark is assuming their numbers are replaced, so if, for example, 75% of those converted throughout the 1st century were no longer alive by the year 100, a reasonable assumption, then by Stark's own estimate, the Christians actually won 32,000 converts over in its first 100 years. If we add the hypothesis that 1 in 4 converts eventually left the faith voluntarily, out of disillusionment, disagreement, persuasion by outsiders, or simple fear, and that should be a fair assumption, even if Christianity was 100% true. After all, roughly 1 in 4 Americans is not a serious Christian today, and Holding would probably argue they have access to sufficient facts to know they are mistaken, while similar ratios exist for deniers of evolution or those who believe Saddam Hussein was involved in the attacks of 9/11, in each case despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Then, according to Stark, the Christians could claim to have appealed to as many as 40,000 members of the population, a population that over that same period of time would have included at least 120 million adults overall. But that's it. Only 1 out of 3,000 people, just 1/30th of 1%, were ever impressed enough to join. That's a trivial scale of success. Indeed, even if we exaggerate beyond all proportion and imagine Stark's math is off by a factor of 10, and Christianity appealed to 400,000 people in the first century, we're still at far less than 1% of the population, comparable to the number of Hindus in the United States today, which we can never claim to be more than a tiny fringe minority. A more thorough survey of the evidence and scholarship pertaining to Christian numbers was provided in a landmark paper by Keith Hopkins. Hopkins rightly explains that no one can claim anything definite on this subject, at least for the first two centuries. And he's right. Anyone who says anything about Christian numbers is speculating and not asserting a fact. This is a fatal problem for Holding, whose argument requires factual premises, not speculative ones. The best we can hope for is to arrive at conclusions that do not contradict any relevant evidence, while conforming to that evidence better than any alternative in light of known historical precedents and scientific models, exactly the standards employed by Stark. And in fact, Hopkins demonstrates the accuracy and plausibility of Stark's conclusion. Thomas Finn also agrees with Hopkins and Stark, and adds further corroborating evidence, while Robin Lane Fox surveys every kind of evidence of Christian numbers anyone could expect to find, especially archaeological, and finds that Christians were practically invisible until the 3rd century, just as Stark's model predicts. We can apparently trust the eyewitness testimony of the Christian scholar Origen that by the dawn of the 3rd century, quote, only a very few, end quote, had joined the Christian movement. In addition to all this, including the direct numerical corroboration of Stark's model from Bagnall's papyrological survey, we have one other statistic that's probably exact and accurate. Bishop Cornelius of Rome tells us the size of the church at Rome in a letter he wrote around 251 AD, which Eusebius quotes at length. In passing, Cornelius gives a list of the personnel, which is so exact it surely derives from financial records, and altogether the total comes to 60 priests of various grades, an additional staff of 94, over 1,500 beggars and widows on the church dole, and other members too many to count. The fact that only dependents and staff were counted means, even at this advanced stage in the church's development, no effort was being made to count the size of its membership, so all earlier counts surely can't be anything more than optimistic boasts or guesses. But from this hard data, different scholars have variously estimated the Roman church at between 14,000 and 30,000, or even as much as 50,000 members, in the year 251. No one argues for anything more than that, and even those numbers are probably too high. With only at most 100 men qualified to lead or supervise services each week, and given that the largest meeting spaces available to Christians at the time could accommodate no more than 100 people, the church at Rome probably could not have claimed more than 11,000 believers, which is pretty close to Stark's prediction of 14,000. There's absolutely no evidence it was larger than that. Of course, there may have been other heretical churches in Rome at the time, though Holding does not regard alternative sects as true Christians. We have no evidence how many false Christians were in Rome anyway, or if Cornelius is actually discounting them. Even so, I'll be freakishly optimistic and run with the largest estimate on the scholarly record, that of Edward Gibbon, over 200 years obsolete and pretty much universally rejected by modern experts as much too large. Let's just assume this same data suggests a Christian population in Rome of 50,000 in 251 AD. All scholars agree the population of Rome at this time exceeded 700,000. Christians, therefore, could claim barely 7% of the population of Rome by the mid-3rd century, even by the most flawed and exaggerated estimate on record, which mathematically entails the church was far smaller in the 2nd century and even smaller in the 1st. In order for there to be only 7% penetration of the population of Rome after more than 200 years, this mathematically requires an average rate of growth no greater than 50% faster than Stark's. Any faster would require implausible phases of zero or even negative growth over several decades in order to fit the facts. Yet increasing Stark's rate of growth by 50% still leaves us with no more than 17,000 Christians throughout the entire Roman Empire by 100 AD, which entails a total tally of converts in the first century of roughly 63,000, using the same assumptions stated earlier. In other words, in its first century, barely 1 in 2,000 people knew about and found Christianity attractive, even assuming the most inflated interpretation possible of the best data we have. So the actual number was certainly much smaller. Stark begins his progression from an initial base of 1,000, but what if there really were 5,000 in around 40 AD, as Acts claim? That number is dubious, but Stark's model would still predict no more than 38,000 members by 100 AD, which means fewer than 200,000 conversions throughout the whole first century, little more than 0.1%. Fewer than 1 in 600 converted after several generations of preaching is still fringe, not a popular success, and this isn't plausible anyway, since to match the hard data that we have for the 3rd century from both Bagnal and Cornelius, the rate of growth of the church would then have to be lower than Stark's estimate. So even starting with 5,000 members in 40 AD, the total number of conversions in the 1st century was probably less than 100,000, not 200,000. Thus, the most credible estimates we have, from what little evidence we have, still get us nowhere beyond a tiny fringe minority and nowhere near a miraculous success. Of course, one could dink the rate of growth around in some voodoo seesaw, with huge losses and zero growth over numerous decades, just to get higher numbers in the first century, but there is no evidence the rate fluctuated so wildly, or at all. Holden cannot say Christianity was miraculously successful in the first century because I say so. It seems the only way to turn is either to accept the Stark model, or a model with even slower net growth than his, or abandon any assertions at all about how many Christians there were in the first century. No one can claim to know, and since Holding's argument requires knowing, his argument fails for lack of data. Any conclusion that actually has evidential support, even if we implausibly start with 5,000 Christians in the year 40, must still fit projections for the 3rd and 4th century, and when we do that, when we use the evidence we have, we never even approach 1% of the population by 100 AD. In fact, we can barely pass 0.1%. The evidence simply does not exist to push the numbers higher. The fact that larger numbers have no support doesn't entail the numbers weren't larger, only that we cannot claim to know they were. And this still means Holding can't claim to know that the scale of Christianity's success was miraculous. Even in the realm of pure speculation, we find little help for his argument. Earlier, we could estimate 400,000 total converts in the first century only by multiplying Stark's prediction by 10, for no reason whatever. This would allow for at most 100,000 members in 100 AD, but again, we're just making this up. We're not arguing from any evidence. But even if by chance we're right, that's still only 1 out of every 300 people converting over the course of 60 years of active recruitment. That means the largest estimate for the whole empire by the end of the first century could never be greater than half of 1%, and again, such a size by 100 AD would entail a subsequent rate of growth far less than Stark's, even to meet the wildly inaccurate estimate of Given for the size of the Roman Church in the mid-3rd century, much less Bagnal's much more reliable data. And that's already stretching the evidence too far. In truth, the numbers must have been less than 0.1% of the ancient population, probably far less, because that's the only estimate that actually fits the data well. So no matter how we try to tweak our growth model, the actual evidence permits only one conclusion. We cannot prove Christianity was attractive to any more than 1 out of every 1,000 people in the first century. That's simply not miraculous, or even surprising. With whom did Christianity begin? Another important point worth a brief survey is the fact that Christianity's limited success in the first century was only among specifically targeted groups who already had their sympathies in the right place. And that meant Jews and Jewish sympathizers and people for whom the social system was not working, especially the working class. As Paul admits, quote, "Not many who are wise in the flesh are called, nor many who are great or noble," end quote. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 26. Those weren't Paul's target audiences. And as James writes, quote, "Did not God choose them that are poor in the world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom? And do not the rich oppress you and drag you into the courts?" End quote. James 2, verses 5 to 6. The social identity of first century Christians is pretty clear in these remarks. I've discussed different aspects of this fact in several previous chapters already, so I will only round out the point here. First, to say that Christianity appealed to the disgruntled lower classes and not the elite must not be mistaken for claiming that Christianity was only successful among the poor, or that no rich people were attracted to it. A significant number of the middle class would be among the same groups sympathetic to the Christian message, including educated men and men with middle management positions in the government, who could easily become disillusioned with a system that wasn't working for them. As long as they were in a position to feel powerless within an unjust social system, despising and unable to enter or overcome the power and influence of those higher up the ladder, they would sympathize with the idea of an unjustly crucified hero among many other elements of the Christian message. And their sympathy would be even greater if they already shared the point of view of those Jews who accepted an ideology of martyrdom and expected a suffering savior. Modern scholars are agreed on the lower class origins of the Christian movement. As John Polhill argues, the author of Luke, himself clearly well-educated, quote, had a concern for people who are oppressed and downtrodden, like Samaritans and eunuchs, and one of Luke's main concerns in Acts was to portray a church without human barriers, a community where the gospel is unhindered and truly inclusive, end quote. Richard Rohrbaugh adds, quote, John is almost certainly a Galilean gospel, written for a group which exists within a dominant society but as a conscious alternative to it. An alienated group which had been pushed or withdrawn to the social margins where it stood as a protest to the values of the larger society, end quote. Or protest to the corruption of those values, as I've explained in previous chapters. While Matthew targeted educated Jews and the retainer class among Greeks, and Mark targeted peasants and other members of the agrarian class among both Jews and pagans, Christianity was most successful in finding sympathizers in these very audiences, those on the bottom and those stuck in the middle, who were growing weary of the failure and corruption of the entire social system. Christianity made little headway into the scholarly, administrative, or economic elite until it had positions of power and authority to offer them within a wealth-generating church hierarchy by the mid to late 2nd century amidst an otherwise collapsing social system in the mid 3rd century, which I'll soon discuss. Rather, on the upper ends of the ladder, Christianity was mainly attractive to the artisan class and appealed to values held by them and not shared by the elite. This is evident in Acts, as Ben Witherington observes, quote, the favorable attitude toward artisans in Luke Acts was not a typical attitude of many in the upper strata of society, but it was typical of how artisans and retainers viewed themselves and how Jews in general viewed work so long as it was not ritually defiling, end quote. In fact, Witherington concludes that Luke himself, quote, is not among the elite of society, since he addresses Theophilus in a mode associated with a person who is willingly or unwillingly in a subordinate position to a person of rank in Roman society, end quote. Theophilus was thus, either actually or fictively, Luke's social superior, and was probably a member of the equestrian class, in our terms, the upper middle class, which means Luke must have been of even lower status. The word Luke uses to address Theophilus is kratistos, Greek for both egregious and clarissimus in Latin, which could denote an equestrian or a senator, but more likely the former, as usually a senator's formal Roman name would take priority in a proper address, whereas here he is identified solely by his Greek name. Senators were usually comparable to a landed aristocracy, whereas equestrians were often working professionals or their sons, which would explain the widely favorable treatment of the values of artisans throughout Luke and Acts. Luke is playing to his audience. I'll discuss the difference in values between the aristocratic and professional classes in antiquity in my forthcoming book, The Scientist and the Early Roman Empire. Thus, when we hear about respectable men and women converting, as for example in Acts 17, verse 12, this implies no actual formal status, but refers to people of means who sought and held a good reputation in their community. Of course, Acts has obvious apologetic reasons to inflate Christianity's success among respectable people. Even so, the artisan class had its share of respectable people, and it's clear that Christianity found friends in that community, as I've discussed in chapter 2. Likewise, while we hear of Pharisee converts, not just Paul, but others in Acts, it should be obvious that these were not the ones writing Talmudic precedent or running rabbinical schools, but those who were, like Paul, marginalized within the Pharisee community, given relatively less authority and respect by more prestigious members of the sect, and who were therefore quite ready to sympathize with criticism of the ungodly snobbery of their peers, like I discussed in chapter 12. At the same time, Christianity first targeted mainly Jews and Jewish sympathizers and worked its way through family acquaintances. Early Christianity, David Da Silva argues, Holding's very own source, was basically a household movement first, in that it sought after the conversion of heads of households whose dependents would follow them into the new faith. In fact, Da Silva goes on to document this fact from the New Testament itself in substantial detail. And, of course, I have already discussed the effective tactic of targeting women in Chapter 11 and heads of household in Chapter 10. Any religion that secures the source of children, especially children of the masses, who far outnumber those of the elite, is going to have a tremendous social advantage. It's also no accident that Christianity was most successful in the first century among prepared audiences, namely Jews and Jewish converts and sympathizers, who already had a good grounding in scripture, were already awed by the divine authority of that scripture, and already attracted to the relevant Jewish ideals, such as the heroism of martyrs and the value of moral austerity. It's notable, for example, that Paul converts only some Jews, but a great multitude of Judaized pagans in Acts 17, verses 1-4. The implication is that those who already showed a propensity to radically relocate themselves in the social environment were the ones most ready to buy the Christian message. Likewise, after their disheartening failure to gain significant headway in Palestine, most Christian success in Acts is gained in the diaspora, and not just geographically, but ideologically. Diaspora Jews had the most cosmopolitan outlook, and had either been pagans or understood pagan ideals quite well. It should not surprise us that they were the most receptive to the Christian mission, which highly syncretized the best of Jewish and pagan ideals into a potent new faith, which sold itself as the perfect culmination of the oldest of all faiths. It's also worth noting that the evidence for God-fearers, pagan converts or sympathizers to Judaism, is quite significant in the first two centuries, unlike the evidence for Christians, which means this class already considerably outnumbered Christians for at least 100 years. So small was Christian success in that time. Therefore, all these factors must be taken into account in any explanation of Christianity's limited success in its first 100 years. The correct explanation must explain not just where Christianity succeeded, but also where it failed. Holding's theory fails this test. According to his theory, those most able and willing to check the facts should have been the most impressed by Christian claims. Instead, they are the least impressed. Elite scholars and Palestinian Jews just weren't profitable markets for the early Christians. In contrast, my theory, which is also the theory advanced by many of Holding's own favorite sources, Molina, Neyre, Rohrbaugh, Da Silva, and nearly every other expert I know, Stark, Fox, Sanders, and which nullifies Holding's theory, proposes that Christianity deliberately gave short shrift to elite values, perceptions, or expectations in order to appeal to the significantly different values, perceptions, and expectations of the lower classes and of those in the upper classes who were located outside the echelons of real power or control, such as middlemen, women, and the slaves of prominent men. This theory predicts that Christianity would get a very cold, even hostile response from the elite, but find receptive audiences among prepared groups outside the elite. Only my theory fits the actual facts of history. Holding tries to deny this by fallaciously shifting the burden onto me when he protests my factually true statement that there is no evidence that any elite scholars converted to Christianity in the first century. Holding continues to insist he has the right to pretend some did, only we have no evidence of it. But he has no such right. By their very nature, elite scholars typically leave evidence of their existence, especially when their team ultimately wins control of the culture and has every reason to preserve its heritage, as the Christians did in the 4th century. So absence of evidence is evidence of absence in this case, meeting the criteria of a valid argument from silence. We can be sure there were none, because had there been, we'd have evidence of it now. Had it been the case that hundreds of such elites were being converted in the 1st century, we would have a much larger body of letters and texts from that century, as Keith Hopkins explains in his work that I referred to earlier. Even allowing a reconstruction of the leading families involved and their connections to each other. Instead, we have very little writing from the first century Christians, and very little information regarding who wrote those things or what their connections were to other elite converts. This state of evidence supports the conclusion that only a very small penetration of the educated class was achieved in that century. I've discussed the scant few first century conversions among the elite claimed in the earliest sources in chapters 1 and 7. Most, if not all, are dubious. But even if genuine, clearly none wrote anything and thus were not among the literary elite. Rodney Stark has tried to argue against the mainstream view that Christianity actually had more success above than below, but Fox and Hopkins both correct Stark on this point. He did not adequately take into account the fact that all written texts, by the very nature of being written, come from Christians of higher social class than most converts, requiring both the skills and the peculiar motivation to put pen to paper, which were distinctions of the educated class, which ranged much wider than the narrower category of the scholarly elite. As a result, Christian texts overrepresent the interests of families with the unusual means and connections to support an education for their children. More careful reading is required to identify the overall status and origins of the whole body of Christian converts. And actual historians like Polhill and Rohrbaugh have done this work, arriving at the consensus position that Christianity actually got started more from the bottom up than the top down. But even if all that weren't so, Holding still can't bootstrap his case with groundless assertions. The fact remains, the evidence does not support the claim that any elite scholars converted in the first century. That's what I said, and that remains true. If Holding wants to rest his case on a groundless assertion that such converts existed, then his conclusion becomes a groundless assertion too, and as I've already said, I'm quite content with that. That his conclusions are groundless is exactly what my critique aims to prove. So I welcome all the assistance Holding wants to give me in proving my case against him. But insofar as the evidence is clearly against there having been any early converts among the scholarly elite, and next to none among the well-established elite, we are faced with having to explain this. Holding's theory cannot, well, mine does. The Rise of World Christianity. In the 3rd century, the Roman Empire withered under 50 years of constant and devastating civil war and massive economic depression, from which the empire never really recovered. By the end of that century, every social institution was in ruins. The economy almost entirely collapsed, as the value of gold, silver, and coin plummeted so low that draconian measures had to be taken by the government even to keep basic services functioning. Since this meant countless endowments for schools went bankrupt, fewer were being educated. Artisans were increasingly among civilian casualties or forced by bankruptcy into unskilled trades or drafted into armies and killed off, thus breaking traditions of art and craft. Fascism hardened at the political level, and the aristocracy was so ravaged by war, assassination, and lethargy that the military pretty much took over, not merely deciding who would rule, as it often had done before, but actually supplying new emperors and leaders from then on out. In the past, a glorious senatorial career was the path to honors and power. Now, a career in the government or military was increasingly the only way to obtain either. What's more, the empire fractured into two. Though it was occasionally reunited, the division only became worse over time until it was complete. Then the Western Empire was destroyed, while the Eastern Empire slowly deflated into oblivion, meeting a slow death of 1,000 years of shrinking talent and territory. This collapse of a once trusted social system and the ensuing atmosphere of turmoil, ruin, and uncertainty became perfect soil for the success of the Christian church. Christianity could flourish during all this because it was a well-organized, empire-wide social services institution that was not connected to or dependent on the system undergoing collapse. That was a powerful advantage. Had any other religion thought of that instead and achieved this entirely natural advantage for itself, it might have replaced Christianity as the religious victor of the Western world. For because of this, Christianity could offer not only a current refuge and a future rescue from a world gone wild, but also a convenient explanation for why it was going to ruin, as I explained in Chapter 6. The Christians had set out from the beginning to create a kingdom of God within the kingdom of Rome, a new community wherein society worked the way the poor and disgruntled wanted it to, realizing communism in place of capitalism, and erasing the privileges of class, increasing exploitations of the system by the church hierarchy notwithstanding. Once the Roman social system was going to ruin, even more members of society became poor, disgruntled, disenfranchised, or disillusioned, more than ever before. Hence, the very groups Christianity most appealed to were now the fastest growing. The Christian church had an established quasi-utopian system in place for them to flock to. for it had always sought to give these groups exactly what they most wanted, and by the 3rd century it was in a better position to provide it than any other institution. The crisis of the 3rd century also threw the game to Christianity because Christians so fervently recruited women and the working classes. This was far more brilliant a move than the disastrous decision of Mithraists, for example, to target only men and to focus primarily on the army. They simply lost their investment when the army ended up utterly devastated over the course of the 3rd century. While Christians were winning over twice as many candidates by appealing to 2 genders, and also earning a huge return on children born and raised into the faith by female converts, Mithraists were seeing none of that action, while watching their numbers get hacked away by 50 years of ceaseless civil war. Anyone can now see who was going to win in that contest. But it was even worse for Mithraism. First, constant military disaster and hardship, without a consistent victory in sight, for 2 whole generations, was widely understood in antiquity to signal the failure of your religion. Therefore, by historical fate alone, Mithraism was doomed to be abandoned, because it was predominantly supported by the very soldiers who were losing and thus seeing no benefit from their piety. Conversely, massive military losses had to be made up with fresh recruits, but who had been recruiting from the remaining pool of manpower? And who was now having more children for recruiters to draft? The Christians. Thanks to their special attention to winning over women and working-class men. Therefore, by the end of the 3rd century, thanks to the ordinary exigencies of historical fate, Mithraism became increasingly unpopular, while the armies, once bastions of Mithraism, were compelled to become increasingly Christian, at precisely the time when most new leaders of the empire were coming from the military. This doesn't mean I imagine Mithraism could have been the Christianity of the future. Mithraism never incorporated the elements of evangelism that constantly drove Christianity, ultimately even to the point of compelling belief on pain of death, torture, or intimidation. I see nothing in Mithraism that would ever have spawned such behavior, and consequently, had there been no Christianity, I suspect there would have simply remained the same religiously diverse society that so well served Rome for hundreds of years before that disastrous 3rd century. I focus on Mithraism only to provide an example of how Christianity got lucky breaks over its competitors that played right into its hand. Of course, one could always claim God ruined society in order to secure Christianity's success, much as Christian apologists have claimed God arranged the murder of millions of Jews simply to bring about the formation of Israel. But I can only hope you have a more rational view of God. For surely an omnipotent being could have brought about both ends without all the pointless misery, and a compassionate God, by definition, would have. At any rate, historians have no trouble finding sufficient causes of these events in natural historical facts, so appeals to God are gratuitous. The 3rd century was decisive in securing the grandiose success of later Christianity, and was indeed a lucky draw from the deck, since nothing about Christianity itself, or caused by it, had anything to do with bringing that crisis about. This was a crisis of the pagan world's own doing, though having little to do with religion, and much to do with the failure to develop a stable constitutional government. So we can't blame Christianity for the fall of the Roman Empire. The triumph of Christianity was a symptom of that fall, not its cause. But there was also a sense in which Christianity exploited this niche by design. Though the early Christians had no way of knowing how everything would fall apart in 200 years, they certainly saw the cracks forming, and specifically sought to repair them, with their moral vision of social reform. And for that very reason, in its first few centuries, Christianity did look like it was working, in a way the wider social system was not, especially since the major social institutions of the time were increasingly failing, getting worse and worse, in exactly those same centuries, thanks to increasing unchecked corruption, of the very same sort that would lead to the collapse of the 3rd century, thus making Christianity look remarkably good, even supernaturally prescient by comparison. Their timing couldn't have been better. Luck strikes again. Had the empire maintained the Pax Romana of the glory years, with the wealth and progress of the 1st and early 2nd century, and had the Senate established a stable constitutional government by the 3rd century, as the movie Gladiator pretended was the real plan of Marcus Aurelius, instead of 50 years of civil war, I suspect Christianity would have been doomed, not to oblivion, but at least to obscurity, a fate much like American Hinduism. Today, Christians would perhaps be a small fringe cult, as they had been before, competing for customers with scores of other cults and sects, assuming the West remained as religious as it actually has. I suspect this because, were the Roman armies victorious and prosperous, instead of decimated and ruined, Mithraism would have been vindicated and would not have lost its hold on the army, though, as I've said, I doubt it would have become a universal religion even within the ranks. At the same time, Christianity would not have had as much to offer anymore, as peace and prosperity would gradually claim more and more potential converts by giving them what they wanted, material happiness and security at the hands of a successful, and therefore obviously divinely sanctioned, pagan government, just as I explained in Chapter 6. It wouldn't be that simple, of course. Any number of unexpected things could happen in the absence of what actually did, and I'm assuming such a period of peace and prosperity in Rome would have opened the door to realizing the trends advocated among the philosophical elite toward greater justice, equality, and reason, instead of Roman society becoming more unequal, unjust, superstitious, and socially polarized as in fact it did. I might be wrong about that, but I doubt I'm wrong about the clear advantages the chaos of the 3rd century gave to Christianity against its competitors, particularly when we factor in the very convenient timing of the fact that its natural and inevitable rate of growth accelerated Christianity's numbers to significant levels exactly during that very century, as Stark, Hopkins, and Finn explain. And when we take into account the fact that everyone is eager to try something new when everything old has failed. Had everything old not failed, new ideas like Christianity would have ceased to gain much purchase. And had the natural progression of steady Christian growth not coincided so well with the collapse of pagan society, it's probable that the forces opposed to Christianity would have succeeded, if not in destroying it, certainly in changing it into something different, as had happened to many other imported cults. Instead, with Christianity's victory over society, elite ideals were vanquished, and 1,000 years of ruin ensued. But that's another story. Conclusion. Even by our best estimates, Christians only managed to persuade 1,000 people to join every few years or so, despite evangelizing nearly 100 cities and beyond, throughout a massive empire of many tens of millions of people. By the end of the 1st century, the church is unlikely to have exceeded even 10,000 active members across the whole empire. That's simply not a miraculous success. However, Holding says he wrote his original essay, and now a book, to respond to the claim that Christianity originated and originally flourished among suckers, quote-unquote. People so gullible they'd believe anything, no matter how absurd. As usual for Holding, that's an exaggeration of what his critics really say. Those who converted to Christianity did indeed have a backward method of inquiry, fervently clung to anti-empirical values, were substantially ignorant of most of what they really needed to know in order to make a sound judgment, and held very different assumptions about God, man, and the universe than we do. But this doesn't mean they would have believed anything. It only means the things they'd be inclined to believe, and in fact did believe, even apart from Christianity, were not limited to the truth, but in fact encompassed a great deal of nonsense. After all, these were people who really thought God lived in outer space, that the whole universe revolved around his created earth, that demons possessed their neighbors and caused madness and disease, that supernatural beings inhabiting the air spoke and appeared to people or worked spells on them, and that bad people were all the puppets of Satan and his legion of devils. Clearly, they had a lot of false beliefs. Claiming their belief that Jesus rose from the grave was false too is hardly a stretch. And that's the real issue here. Holding is upset by early Christians being called suckers and early Christian ideology being called absurd, but the fact is these are relative terms. From their point of view, they were not suckers, but fortunate. Most of them got what they wanted, or very near to it. A brief glimpse of happiness and comfort within a surrogate family that really met their needs, emotionally and materially, with the hope of even more in a utopian future. And they took a shot at what they honestly thought would right the wrongs of their dysfunctional society. They were wrong, but then being passionately wrong about a grand plan to fix society puts them in good historical company. Likewise, converts obviously didn't think a Christian's claims were absurd, that's why they converted. These ideas were only absurd to those who committed to worldviews very different from the masses, such as the ancient naturalists and their sympathizers. It just so happens that those naturalists turned out to be on the right track, and the mystics on the wrong one. This is something I'll show in my forthcoming book, The Scientist and the Early Roman Empire. Hence, a modern scientific thinker has far more right to call early Christian beliefs absurd than even the ancient critics did. But our charge of absurdity comes from knowledge, knowledge the ancients didn't have. Let's face it, demonic possession, exercised by laying on hands and uttering words of power, is indeed absurd. yet it was a fundamental component of the Christian religion at the time. So we can't honestly doubt that ancient Christianity was at least partly absurd, and if partly, why not entirely? The word sucker, on the other hand, implies being duped by a con man, but there's no need to suppose early Christians were being conned. Maybe some were, but I'll bet those who started the movement really believed their dreams, visions, and interpretations of Scripture. And even at worst, I'll bet they fabricated these things for a noble moral purpose, not for material gain or some scheme to steal souls or any such nonsense. Later Christians might be a different story, but I'm sure the first Christians were sincere. They really thought they had a good idea for saving the world. And that feeling is a powerful drug. It has fueled every zealot, every fanatic, every passionate revolutionary in history. Moreover, to say someone would believe anything, no matter how absurd, implies they would believe it even knowing it was absurd. But that isn't the case here. Early Christian beliefs were not seen as absurd by converts, only by critics, because converts and critics embraced very different worldviews right from the start. No Christian would have believed anything they felt was absurd, and they didn't. For example, to a Christian, it was absurd even to think that a courageous and morally upright man who could heal the sick and expel demons was not an emissary of God's will. Of course, this means their definition of absurdity was very different from ours. What we've seen throughout all these chapters is that Christianity was indeed repulsive, absurd, or just plain false from the point of view of most people of the time, pretty much as Holding says. But Christianity never attracted most people, by honest argument and evidence, that is, since the use of force and political and social pressure was ultimately necessary to win that majority centuries after the mission began. It's quite true that had Christianity made itself more attractive to more people, it would have been more successful than it was, more quickly and with far less effort. But the end result was the same. Over time, Christianity changed to become more attractive to more people by developing more appealing doctrines and incorporating popular festivals and superstitions. That was the only way it really could succeed, and that was the only way it actually did. Just imagine how horrified Paul would have been at the cult of saints, for example, which was really just polytheism in disguise, complete with revering statues and artifacts and praying to specific deities who had power over specific aspects of life. With that system in place, the average pagan could hardly tell the difference between his beliefs and a Christian's. And even today, only by making itself more popular has any branch of Christianity managed to succeed in the modern free world. But in the beginning, Christianity was a radical idea to most, but for that very reason, it was not very successful by any objective standard, except within a very small cross-section of the population, primarily those disgruntled with or oppressed by the values and institutions of the dominant society. And from the point of view of those few, Christianity was an attractive idea whose time had come. This minority did not need irrefutable evidence that Jesus rose from the grave, because they had irrefutable evidence that the Christian message had the backing of God, in the moral superiority of believers and their ability to work miracles, interpret Scripture with surprising insight, and speak of God's will with charismatic inspiration. This is hardly irrefutable evidence for us, because we know a lot more than they did about human nature and the workings of the body, mind, and universe. We know that none of their evidence entails the conclusion, or even so much as strongly implies it. But that's us. We have the advantage of hindsight and of scientific knowledge and reason. They didn't. That doesn't make them suckers, it just makes them wrong. Nor does it mean their beliefs were absurd to them. It just means they were false. This has been Not the Impossible Faith, Why Christianity Didn't Need a Miracle to Succeed. Written by Richard Carrier, PhD. Narrated by Richard Carrier. Copyright 2009, Richard Carrier. Production copyright 2013 by Pitchstone Publishing.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.